I'd like to just begin with a few words on the just to round off some of the discussion from the last lecture. This seems to be the typical pattern that I afterwards feel like I rushed at the end and didn't get to finish certain important ideas. At the end of the discussion on race last week, I broached the question of what should be done. So if race continues to be an ongoing dimension of not only inequality, but of oppression, that is, an inequality that's linked to injustice and discrimination, if that's an ongoing reality, not just a thing of the past, the question is what should be done about it? Some of the things are kind of obvious, at least obvious in the context of what I've said before. So, for example, I think that serious, systematic anti-poverty programs of different sorts also bear on the question of race because of the connection between race, inequality, and poverty. But the most uncertain kind of solution, the kind of policy which causes the most controversy, goes under the expression affirmative action. And I then endorsed, but didn't really have time because we were running out of time to explain why, I endorsed that in the world that we happen to find ourselves at this point in history, I don't see an alternative to affirmative action as a way of countering the pernicious effects of existing ongoing discrimination. Now that's a very controversial thing to say, and I think it's important to clarify it. Part of the clarification is this. There are no such things in many contexts as perfect policies. That is, policies which serve to advance some goal and which don't have any downside, any negative aspects. Anybody who thinks there are simple, unproblematic solutions to complex problems, anybody who thinks that is simply wrong. I don't think this isn't a matter of my ideological or political position. I think this is a kind of deep fact about the nature of complexity. It is simply not the case that you can tackle complex problems without having to worry about trade-offs. That on balance you may say, yes, this is the best we can do, but the best we can do doesn't mean that there aren't problems associated with the policy itself. Now, affirmative action is about as good an example of this as one could imagine, because it's not that affirmative action inherently, in and of itself, embodies things that at least I think are desirable. I don't think it's a good thing to use race or other characteristics such as race, gender, ethnic background. I don't think it's inherently a good thing for those to be criteria by which people get access to positions. I think that the ideal world, a world which if I could snap my fingers and have it just magically exist, would be a world in which there was both no discrimination in the daily lives of people and no need for having race, ethnicity, religion, gender, etc., be part of our criteria for how people get access to positions. I'd like both of those things to be true, if I could snap my fingers and have it happen. The question is, you can't snap your fingers and have it happen. If indeed discrimination based on race and other criteria, but we're focusing on race here, is an ongoing daily reality in the world in which we happen to find ourselves, then the question is, what are the remedies? Now, one answer is there are no remedies. Now, that's a possible answer. One can say that this is an unfortunate thing, it's unfair, it's unjust, but one could argue that all remedies are worse than the problem. Now, that's one kind of position. That's a position that, when it's made by people in secure and privileged positions, seems a little bit like special pleading for their own interests. You know, it doesn't ring as an authentic view when somebody who is very advantaged says, gee, it's just too bad, there's nothing we can do about this. But it's a possible answer, and it could be a correct answer in the sense that it could be the case that the negative effects of something like affirmative action way outbalance their positive effects. But that's how you have to think about it. The trade-offs, the negative effects versus the positive effects. Now, my evaluation in terms of the empirical evidence that I've seen, so this is not just a question of armchair opinion, it's the result of looking at and thinking about the research on these questions. My view is that at this point in history, the positive effects significantly outweigh whatever the negative effects are. I've observed this in academic institutions. That's the main place where I've seen this happen. When there are affirmative action type policies in place in universities, what it means is that universities very actively go out to recruit minorities in order to get the best possible candidates they can. And the result is an increase in the proportion of minorities on the faculty and the staffs and in the student bodies of universities, way beyond what would have happened if all that was relied upon was the goodwill of the people making such choices. And that has the effect then of undermining the subtle and backroom types of discrimination that otherwise affect admissions. Remember the slides we looked at. The employment audit, remember that concept of employment audit, where an experiment was done. People went out to get jobs. Some were black, some were white, some had prison records, some had not for nonviolent offenses. And the callbacks were heavily shaped by both race and the stigma of a prison record. Another experiment of a similar sort was done by sending out resumes in which the names on the resume were characteristically associated with the black community and the white community. These were people in which on the resume they had exactly the same experience, the same education, the same GPAs. So in every respect other than their name, they were identical. And again, job interviews were heavily differentiated on the basis of whether the resume had a African-American associated name or not. How do you counter that? You can't really rely on people suing for discrimination. It's just not realistic. In principle, of course, that's what that's what a liberal market society says. If you're treated unfairly, the recourse is to take the offender to court and sue them. But that's simply not a feasible solution. It just doesn't work because people can't afford it and they can't gather the evidence that they themselves were personally discriminated against. You might be able to bring this employment audit to show that people like you are discriminated, but how do you show that you yourself were discriminated? How do you get evidence of that? You can see it's a very daunting task. Affirmative action is a solution. It has downsides, but I think at this point in history, in order to really break this cycle of ongoing discrimination in the access to positions, some form of affirmative action is probably a necessary component of the process. All right, on to gender. Most of what we've talked about so far in the course, at least many of the topics, I think deal with issues that, particularly in this middle part of the course, that don't deeply impact most of your lives. Most of you come from relatively affluent families. University of Wisconsin undergraduates are in the top 20% of the, on average, of the economic distribution in the state of Wisconsin. This class is overwhelmingly white. Most of you have many of you have even benefited from rising inequality in the United States. That is, if you come from relatively affluent upper income families, that's the segment of the American population that has done pretty well in the course of the last 3 decades of increasing inequality. But you have all lived in families. Your lives are all deeply embedded in gender relations. It's inescapable. If you're white and affluent, you can kind of pretend that race doesn't matter in the US, because it doesn't matter that much for you in this narrow sense. And you can kind of imagine that inequality doesn't matter all that much. At least it hasn't affected your lives. But all of your lives are really deeply, profoundly affected by the character of gender relations and by the extraordinary transformation of gender relations which we are currently living through. The transformation of gender in the world today, and I'll speak of the United States in particular, over the last generation or so, is a more rapid social change probably than any in history. You know, if you've studied history, you know, you've heard about the Industrial Revolution, you know, this fantastic transformation in human productivity that occurred in the course of the late 18th through the 19th century, a destruction of the centrality of agriculture in the lives of most people and the rise of industry and the big city and so on. That took a century. The transformation of gender relations from relatively traditional gender roles to the much more fluid and open structure of gender relations we have now is occurring within the lives of people, not across generations. It's occurring within generations. Or another way to think about it, use perhaps a slightly exaggerated language, the human species has been around for roughly 100,000 years or so. Quote, civilization in the sense of organized cultures which are able to record their own affairs have been around for 4,000 or 5,000 years. So we've got roughly, shall we say, somewhere, depends on when you want to count the beginning of human societies, but we've got tens of thousands of years in which very clear gender roles, where there was the right thing for men to do and the right thing for women to do, and their roles were assigned from birth, those gender-differentiated roles have been part of human culture. And in the last generation or two, that's been shattered. It's extraordinary. A sociologist called this era the era of gender vertigo, you know, kind of dizziness, where the very meaning of gender and gender relations has begun to unravel and be reconstructed on a new basis. So this topic is one that really should hit home. This bears on the lives of everyone. Many discussions of gender seem to suggest that when you're studying gender, you're really studying women. That's not true. Gender relations is a study of relations, not just women. It's a study of the social relations which create the categories that we think of as men and women, both. Gender impacts the lives of men as deeply and profoundly as it does the lives of women. And that's what we're going to engage with this week. The first topic is a kind of parallel topic to the way we began the account of race. So you remember when we began race by saying race is not a biological category. That's the key idea that grounds all sociological discussions of race. That race is a socially constructed category, not a biological category. It takes biological differences as raw material, it's the kind of input, but then it does this extraordinary thing of reconstructing it as a social category. And when it becomes a social category, its biological lineage virtually disappears, even though biological markers remain important. Now, that's a really hard thing to understand, I think. It's not an easy idea in the race context. It's an even tougher idea to understand in the gender context. It's a really tough idea for the gender context. What does it mean to say that gender is a social category, not a biological category. Well, here's some definitions, just to get us off the ground here. First, sex is a biological distinction based on the roles in the process of biological reproduction. So sex is indeed a biological category. There are some somewhat fringe sociologists who want to argue that even sex differentiation, is socially constructed. That's associated with certain strands of what's sometimes called postmodernist social theory. I'm not going to go there. I'm perfectly content to say sex is a biological distinction based on the roles in biological reproduction. Gender is a social distinction between roles and expectations linked to sex. Animals do not have a gender, right? Animals don't have gender. Animals have sexes. There are male and female dogs. There's not a dog that's a man. I mean, you know, I don't know what the gendered name would be for a dog that was male. A couple of years ago, there was a Kentucky Derby filly. I forget the name of the Rachel Alexander, was it something like that? Rachel or something? There's a horse in the Kentucky Derby that was a female horse. And when this horse was running, there were lots of interviews with women who were thought to kind of feel some particular empathy for this filly that was running and the favorite to win the Kentucky Derby. And in that discussion, there were TV reporters asking women things like, well, what do you think of this horse who's of the same gender as you are? From a sociological point of view, that's a nonsense statement. Horses don't have genders. They have sexes. Gender is a social category. It's a social transformation of a biological difference into a social difference. Gender norms, this word norms, gender norms are the rules of appropriate behavior and appropriate roles for men and women. Now, the problem that we face here is that there does seem to be, to most people throughout most of history, a purely natural rather than social connection between the roles of biological men and women and their sexes. And in particular, the sex difference between men and women explains why it is that women bear children. Babies are gestated in the wombs of women. We do not yet have what science fiction writers call extra utero gestation. There's a really interesting science fiction story, a novel, called Woman at the Edge of Time. I recommend it. It's just a good science fiction tale in which there is a radically egalitarian society around sex difference. There's absolutely no role differences between men and women. But the basis for that radical egalitarianism is extra utero gestation. So men contribute sperm and women contribute eggs, but babies are gestated outside of bodies. And that's the device in the story to make possible a de-differentiation of social roles based on sex. Now, what that science fiction story has as its kind of premise is this idea that in real societies, by virtue of the fact that women bear children, it's also natural that they have primary responsibility for rearing children. Now, rearing children, mothering, is a social role. That's a social role. That's a set of activities that takes place within a particular social unit, the family, where there's a division of labor over tasks needed for the well-being of all members of the family. That's called a division of labor. The domestic division of labor refers to the division of labor in the household, in the family, and the division of labor within which the biological bearers of children become the social rearers of children. That connection seems completely natural, not social. And that's the core grounding, I think, for the more general view that gender roles are natural. That it's natural for women to become, to fill roles of nurturance, of child rearing, of caregiving. And then once we get into a more complex society, all the caregiving roles that are outside the family begin to be thought of as the proper and natural roles for women. Ultimately, that naturalness seems rooted in the biological facts. Now, here's the kind of interesting thing about this. I think historically, that linkage is real. It's not just made up. It is the case that in a world with high infant mortality, where child rearing involves lactation for an extended period of time, all of those things coming together create a tight connection between the biological facts of the case and the way societies have constructed the roles. There is a causal connection between those historically. But what happens when social change and technologies develop to the point that there is no longer any inherent connection between bearing children and rearing children because of our capacity to organize it in alternative ways? Increasingly, when that is the case, the naturalness of that connection no longer explains the role differentiation. The role differentiation becomes increasingly explained by the way we organize our social affairs, not simply by the biological facts. Now, let me illustrate this in what I hope won't be too complicated a representation. This comes from work that I've been doing around the question of gender equality and what that might mean. So here's the way to look at this graph. This graph also appears in the chapter in the book on this topic. What's on the x-axis here is the amount, the intensity of caregiving behavior in biological men and women. So men and women here are just the biological categories. And this is the world in which we live today, in which we can rate every person, you know, every person in this room, every person in American society, we could rank, could give them a score. How intensely are they engaged in caregiving activities of one sort or another? This would include the sort of informal emotional work that people do with their intimate friends and partners around sort of taking care of their emotional life, listening, nurturing, comforting, all these sorts of things, but also the kind of practical tasks of caregiving for infants, for the aged, for disabled, etc. So we could, you can see there's something we could think of as caregiving behavior. It's connected to certain internal dispositions, how nurturant a person you are. Some people get a lot of gratification out of taking care of others. Others find it a complete pain in the ass to do. There's variation in your internal dispositions and variation in your behavior, right? So this is straightforward. Now, we can say in American society, on average, women engage in more caregiving behaviors than do men. And there's some distribution among biological men and biological women in how intense is their engagement with this kind of activity. We associate caregiving with women, but it is certainly the case that not all women do much caregiving. And there are certainly men who do a lot of caregiving. So there's a distribution and there's an overlap. This is the distribution, and this part of the curve, men are overlapping with the heart of the curve for women. Now this is the way it is in the existing society, in which the behavior of men and women is governed not merely by their internal dispositions. It's not simply how much caregivingness you have in your heart, what's in your own internal state, how much you are fulfilled by that activity. That's not the only reason why people do it. They also do it because they're expected to do it. That's what it means to have norms. There's expectations that if you're a woman and you have a baby, you're supposed to take care of it. And that the father helps, as opposed to the expectation that when there's a baby in a family, fathers should do the caring and women should help, or they should both care equally. The general expectation in our culture, in spite of the big changes over the last generation or two, is that it's the main responsibility for the women. It's why mothers who are forced to do less caregiving often feel very guilty about it. They don't feel just that they're not doing as much as they want to do. They feel guilt about it. That's a sure signal that there's a social force at work. Guilt means you've internalized these norms as to what you ought to do, how you ought to be. Okay, this is what it looks like in the United States today. This is my hypothesis. If we lived in a world, and you know, it's a hypothesis and a weak prediction, this is what I think it will look like at the end of the 21st century, when your grandchildren come of age, as it were. You know, when there'll be four generations in the era of the transformation of gender relations, not just one. You know, you're more or less the first generation to be born in a world where these expectations were really crumbling. I was born in 1947. The 50s is the kind of last gasp of the old-fashioned, traditional male breadwinner model, female domestic worker. In a world where there was very weak expectations, where nobody expects men or women to do more of this, I think women on average will still do a little bit more caregiving than men. That is, I don't think all of the difference that we observe between men and women is because of external expectations and the way those external expectations become internalized as identities, as social identities. I don't think it's all due to that. But I do think it's mostly due to that. I would suspect that there'll be somewhat more intensity of caregiving behavior among women than among men, but that the distributions will mostly overlap. And because they mostly overlap, I think this small gap would be stable. Now, if this was somehow the natural, spontaneous division between men, biological men and women, let us suppose that because of neurological hardwiring and the way our hormones work, that independently of social convention, this is what the dispositions, not just the behavior, but the dispositions, the internal states of women and men were like. If that were true, it would be very hard to sustain this very small gap, right? Be very hard to sustain because the natural proclivity of men would be to shy away from taking care of babies. I'm using that as the iconic case of caregiving labor. And the natural proclivities of women would be to gravitate to that. And that would constantly recreate the social roles, the social expectations. I don't think that's right. That's my hypothesis. It's extremely hard to make get convincing data for this because the actual world we live in always combines social expectations with internal dispositions. They're always combined and they interact. And it's very tough to figure out empirical research that would decisively erode that. The anecdotal evidence is simply the magnitude of the change that we've observed already in such a short period of time, in the amount of caregiving work within families that men now ordinarily do compared to what they did in previous generations. And this is pretty strong indication that the gap can be way less than this, whether it's as narrow as I'm describing here or as narrow as I'm hoping here. That's, I think, an open question. The claim that gender relations are socially constructed is precisely the claim that this gap is not just because of biology. It's because of the rules of the game and the pressures on people created by our institutions that prevent this pattern from occurring. On just a personal note on these matters, one of the fantastic privileges of my particular job, being a professor, is that the time flexibility of academic life made it possible for me to be very heavily involved in the raising of my children. Even when they were little, I had a crib in my office, and when students came for office hours, I would often be tending a baby. I have two now grown daughters when they were babies. And it was relatively easy for me to organize much of my academic work to be based at home so that I could be heavily involved in the daily child tending activities, not just evenings and weekends. That was a struggle. It was not easy. It was very easy to slide into routines, particularly when the children lived with us, where I did less than my fair share of housework. I mean, this was a continual source of issue in my household, whether I did my fair share of ordinary housework. I don't think there was as much conflict, there was hardly any around my fair share of child rearing, but around the housework, my kind of spontaneous proclivity would be to slide into the more typical male role on that. So these are issues. One source of data that one has as a sociologist when you think about social change is introspection, reflection on one's own life. Part of my sense of optimism about the possibilities of further transformation of gender relations comes from my own experience of how fulfilling it is for a man to live within more egalitarian forms of gender relations in one's intimate sphere of family life. And therefore, I see gender equality as a form of male liberation, not just female liberation. Giving men permission and contexts where they can play these nurturant roles, in a sense where men can be mothers as well as fathers, if you will, using the social labels. Okay, that's the introduction. And it's if one of the things to remember from this course, you know, down the road, not to mention next week, is gender is a social category, not a biological category. And then to puzzle about that. That's the formula, right? That's the kind of slogan. Gender is a socially constructed category. The intellectual task is to really puzzle about what that means, to kind of turn it over in your mind. Think about different aspects. Think about different aspects of the way men and women are in the world today that you think of as socially constructed and aspects that you think maybe are more rooted in biology. And then query your own intuition that it's rooted in biology. a lot of what we think of as masculine and feminine, the words masculine and feminine refer to traits. Male and female refer to the biological distinction, men and women to the social roles. A lot of what we think of as masculine and feminine, you know, when you really think about it, there are plenty of women who have traits, behaviors, that one thinks of as rather masculine, and many men who have traits and behaviors that we think of as rather feminine. And then the question is, why do we continue to classify these by virtue of their biological and gendered character, as opposed to just thinking of these as traits which are distributed among both men and women in different mixes? All right, that's the introduction. Now let's look at the empirical story. And this is pretty straightforward. The book is filled with lots of data on this. I will fairly quickly review some of the most interesting of these facts. This is a kind of mapping of this civilization-transforming changes that have occurred in the last couple of generations. I say three generations, you know, it's a little hard to know when to start noting the real beginnings of this massive change. That's less important than understanding the scale of the changes that have occurred. I want to look at seven changes. These are seven headings to think about change. Legal rights, labor force participation, occupational structure and income, power, family structure, the division of labor in the family, and sexuality. Okay, first, legal rights. Just a quick rundown. Today is voting day. It's a little weird to think that less than a century ago, women were not allowed to vote. They were not thought of as competent. You know, there's some things that, try as I might, I just can't put my head in the position of imagining. How could it be in a world which was as committed to the notion of liberal freedoms as the United States was, that mature adult women were thought of as lacking the necessary rationality to vote? And that was taken for granted. Now, there were objectors to it. You know, it's a mistake to think that just because this was the way the power structure worked and those were the way legal rights were done, that there was absolute agreement across the whole population. Certainly by the time the right to vote was granted, there had been decades of women's struggle, the suffragette movement, to gain that right. But even at the time of the American Revolution, there were women, most notably, I think, Abigail Adams in her famous letters to her husband, who questioned the subordination of women as something that should be viewed as natural. But still, it was not until 1920, less than 100 years ago, that women were deemed capable by the official laws of the land to vote. It wasn't until the early 30s that married women had the right to carry their own passport. I didn't realize that until relatively recently. The equal right to divorce only emerged in the course of the 1940s. Now, whatever you think about divorce, you know, there's a spectrum of views as to whether it should be made easy or hard, whether you should have to have a strong legal case to break a marriage, or whether it should be relatively easy, what's now called no-fault divorce. People can just say they no longer want to be married, and that's all it takes now to get a divorce. Regardless of your views on that, there's the additional view as to whether the rules for a woman suing for divorce should be different from the rules for a man suing for a divorce. There was a time when women could not sue for divorce. Only men could. In some parts of the world, that's still true. Women do not have the right to initiate a divorce. But in the United States until the 1940s, and it took a while, that's when it began in the 1940s, women had a much tougher time suing for divorce than a man did. And that's because of an older tradition in which a marriage was seen as the creation of a relationship in which the woman was kind of the property of the man. It's not property in the same sense that a slave was property, but it had property-like qualities. Her rights were derivative from the rights of her husband. Reproductive rights were really only seriously established in the late 60s and into the 1970s. Reproductive rights meaning the right to access to contraception, to control over one's own fertility, and the right to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. And as I think everybody knows, those rights have been under assault in recent years as well. Now, I think that's the most interesting example of an aspect of women's rights and the transformation of the legal status of gender. That's an interesting example where the controversies over it get very confused. I'm not going to get into a discussion, not that it isn't important, but to the discussion over abortion rights, the right to choose, the right to life, I mean, all of these kinds of considerations. And to try to really understand the extent to which the issue of abortion is actually about the rights of women, or, as some people claim, the issue of abortion is about the rights of fetuses, not the rights of women. That's a heavy debate. It's fraught with religious implications. It has occurred in a context where the general rights for women have been strengthened, and which were a necessary condition for these rights over one's own body and reproduction to become established in law. Equal rights to university admissions only began in the 1960s. It was perfectly legal to have quotas to restrict the number of women admitted to college, to universities. There was nothing illegal about that, just as there was nothing illegal about restricting admission to African Americans. One thing to remember, by the way, about affirmative action is that for generations we had affirmative actions for white men. White men had affirmative action to have privileged access to these institutions. That's our history. The reverse forms of affirmative action have broken that pattern. We still, by the way, to most universities have affirmative action for the parents of alumni, particularly the children of alumni, particularly the children of rich alumni. If you are a Harvard graduate and you want your children to get admitted to Harvard, one way to do it is to make big contributions to Harvard. Your children then get classified as legacy admittance. Now, it's not the case that every child of a rich Harvard alumni gets automatically admitted, but they certainly get an easier ride getting in. Their SAT scores can be much lower. That's affirmative action for the children of alumni. And there are good reasons for it, because the endowments of the universities are aided by admitting the children of rich alumni. That's a good thing for the university. It adds to the wealth of the endowments of university. So you can say there's a trade-off. The university's concerned with its financial future, but of course this is unfair. Once again, policies always have trade-offs. This is going back to my earlier comments about affirmative action. Equal rights to jobs were also only established in the 1960s. There were many bars, many rules that prohibited women from having certain kinds of jobs in the United States simply by virtue of being women. That became illegal only in the 1960s. There was a time in the United States when if you were a female school teacher and you got married, you had to quit your job in some parts of the United States. Married women were not allowed to be school teachers. Seems totally bizarre now, and it was not true everywhere in the United States, but there were places that had marriage, what are called marriage bars. And finally, equal rights to participate in sports only occurred with Title IX, in the legislation that made this possible. The fantastic levels of women's involvement in university sports today is directly a result of the legislation that said universities had to provide equal opportunity for women to participate in sports as for men. Which led to a lot of gripes, because the only way to accomplish that was for certain sports that men previously played at universities to no longer get university funding, for those sports to become, you know, intramural sports rather than varsity sports, in order to have equal funding on a per student basis for male and female sports. All right, that's legal rights. Labor force participation. These graphs, almost all of the graphs which are going to follow, which are following here, come from the book. Some of them have been updated a little bit, but since the main thing is just to see the patterns. In 1900, less than 10% of married women with children under 6 or with children at all were in the labor force. By 2007, even for children, for married women with young children under 6, 60% were in the labor force. You can see that this curve didn't just increase in a linear fashion. A linear fashion means you could draw a straight line from here to here, and it would just look like that, just increasing a little bit. It didn't increase very much at all until after the 1940s. If this graph had more refinements, it would look like this and then shoot up, really shoot up here. It started the heavy increase in 1940. Then a very massive increase until the beginning of the 21st century. This means a massive exodus of women from a life entirely spent inside of the domestic unit as their adult activities. Now, it's worth noting that this image for all women, there were always groups of women for whom it was not the case. That is, that they worked outside of the home, even in 1900. And particularly if you looked at poor women and African American women, there was always more labor force participation than among more privileged categories. Occupational structure and income. So this is just a set of illustrative examples of the changes since 1930. And as you can see, the changes between 1930 and 1960 were pretty modest for each of these. If you look at lawyers and judges or physicians and surgeons, it's true that there was an increase between 1930 and 1960, but very modest. The huge increase occurred between 1960 and 1990. There was a time in which virtually no woman studying at a university aspired to be a lawyer or a doctor, whereas now that's common. How many women in this class are kind of thinking about maybe going to law school and medical school? So we've got more prospective doctors than lawyers here, and I'm sure you will all thrive, but you're able to do that because you don't live in this world. You live in this world. And it's not even seen as a bold move, right? This is just one of the things, if you're academically you know, talented and you're serious about your work and you want to have a job that's interesting and productive, one of the things you think about is, oh, maybe I'll go to medical school. This is the pattern of enrollments in medical school and law schools, the percentage of enrollments that are women. And this really shows where the leap occurs, right? So even as late as 1970, less than 10% of enrollments in medical school and in law school were women. The big jump happens in the 70s. And then it continues to the present period. In the most recent data, you know, it's very, very close to 50-50 in terms of enrollments in medical schools and law schools. There still, however, are some very highly sex-segregated jobs. This is just a kind of sample of job categories that are either heavily female-dominated or heavily male-dominated. I have yet to ever have a dental assistant who was a man. Has anybody in the class ever had their teeth cleaned by a man? Great. So that the person that you did was in this 2.9% range of dental hygienists. There are, I think this is, for airline pilots, I suspect this is already increased because it's not that uncommon now. I do a lot of flying around. It's not that uncommon where I see women pilots, both pilots and co-pilots now in the airline industry. Here's the graph for male and female median wages. This is, I think this is probably 2005 wages, that is, they've adjusted for inflation. In 1973, women earned 63% of men's wages on average. In 2005, it's 82% of men's wages. There has been, obviously, an improvement in the relative wages of women and men. Power. This is a graph that isn't in the book. I think the statistics might be referred to in the book, but the graph itself isn't. This is the percentage of large corporations that have at least one woman on the board of directors. So this isn't the percentage of people on the boards of directors who are women. It's the percentage of boards of directors that have at least one woman. Now, the interesting question here is, does this show an increase of tokenism, that is, that every board of directors wants to have at least one woman? How much does this show a real expansion of the role of women in directing large corporations? And this graph, I think, indicates at least one aspect of that. This is the percentage of corporate officers in the largest 500 firms. This is the percentage of CEOs in the largest 1,000 firms who are women. This is of the actual percentage of the actual people who are women. As you can see, it's simply not the case that women have made major inroads into chief executive officers of large corporations. It's still under 4%, at least as of 2008. I don't have more recent data for that. In terms of all executive officers, it's increased to 16%, but still, that's these top levels of power within large corporations remain heavily male-dominated. It's one of the areas in which gender relations have not yet substantially changed. Women elected officials. Here we do see change. in all of these arenas of elections, the US Congress, statewide elections, state legislatures. In this election for the US Senate, there are 18 women contesting seats, including in Wisconsin, where Tammy Baldwin is running for US Senator. And we know for sure that at least one of them will be elected because both candidates in Hawaii are women. So we're guaranteed 100% to have one additional woman senator from Hawaii. And at least in a number of these other races, the expectation is that women will win. Still, the United States is not at the forefront of the movement of women into positions of political power. This is of women in national legislatures. So in the US, this would be both the House and the Senate. In most other countries, it's Parliament rather than a two-house system. In the United States, it's a little over 15% of all legislators at the national level are women. In Sweden, it's over 45%. I don't have the number for Norway. I believe in Norway it's now over 50%. Family structure. So that, just to kind of summarize that last little bit, I think that, of course, as I've been saying, there's been fantastic changes in gender relations, women entering the labor force, women entering traditionally male professions, economic inequality between men and women declining as wage parity is approached. There have been less dramatic transformations of women in positions of power. Some, these are still significant changes, some change but less. Less in corporations and less in political power. And at least with respect to political power in the United States, women lag behind advances of women in national politics in other countries. Now, family structure. This graph shows the percentage of households that consist of a married couple. Households. A household is a unit of shared consumption, basically. People who pool their incomes and live together in shared consumption is the kind of technical definition. In 2008, 50% of all households consisted of a married couple. In 1940 and 1950 and 1960, even up to 1970, it was over 70%. Very substantial decline in the percentage of households who have that form. This graph shows the percentage of women in their early 30s who have never married. That has risen dramatically since 1960. Currently, over a quarter of women in their early 30s have never been married. In 1960, that was only 6.9%. The domestic division of labor. This is basically the how people in their families divide up the tasks. This is time devoted by mothers and fathers to routine house cleaning. This was where I ran into more difficulty than child rearing. Routine house cleaning. In 1965, the average, and the reason I'm restricting this to mothers and fathers, this is restricted to families that have children living in the home. That's the part of the life cycle where the issue of how you divide up the work becomes most pressing because there's the most work to be done. So in 1965, women did 23 times more housework of routine cleaning than men did. By 1975, this had declined to 13.5. But note that the decline was entirely because women were doing less housework. They were doing 12 hours of routine cleaning a week down from about 19. By 2005, the ratio was only 4.4 to 1. And again, much of this was because of the decline in how much housework women were doing. But finally, men began to do a little bit more. One of the results of women's greater labor force participation in households with small children is that households are messier. The cultural standards for how clean a house needs to be, how well ordered, in order for it to be respectable, those cultural standards have declined tremendously. I think it's a good thing that it's declined. It's part of the egalitarian spirit that if there are certain tasks that nobody wants to do, rather than have one person do them excessively, certain things just don't get done. And I think that's okay. Probably a deterioration of the standards of household cleanliness is one of the necessary byproducts of a more egalitarian society. This is the pattern for child care. In the book, by the way, it says time spent per day, but it should be per week. It's a typo in the book. This is the pattern for child care. The ratio now is roughly 2 to 1. It used to be 4 to 1. Child care is something that fathers always did more of. If you look in detail at the kind of child care, the fathers are more involved in the recreational aspects of rearing children, sports especially, but the more recreational stuff, whereas mothers were more involved in the pure maintenance aspects of child care. But nevertheless, I think there has been improvements in how much men participate. An interesting thing, which we won't have time to discuss, but sociologists of the family and genders have given a lot of attention to this. An interesting thing is what's happened to the amount of hours per week of this is active child care, not passive child care. So if your kids are parked in front of a television and you're cooking dinner, that's not child care. You have to be doing stuff with the children to count as child care in this. So this is hours per week. It's gone way up, the number of hours per week that mothers spend with their children actively, even though family sizes have gone down, and even though their labor force participation has gone up. What that increase for women reflects is a change in the expectations for how heavily involved in rearing children parents should be. It's sometimes referred to as the problem of the super mom, you know, or the helicopter parent, you know, the parents who are monitoring every activity of their kids, who are constantly driving them around from one activity to another, rather than just letting the kids go outside and play, organizing their activities, being heavily involved. That's led to an increase in parenting labor for both fathers and mothers. And it's especially striking in a context where the demands on women have increased outside of the home that this has occurred inside of the home as well. Nevertheless, in spite of this increase in how many hours per week mothers are involved in their children, fathers have increased proportionately their involvement to a greater extent, so that the ratio, the disproportion, has gone down. You see, both have gone up from here, but the father's participation has gone up proportionately more. They still don't do an equal share on average, but they do proportionately more than they did in the past. Finally, sexuality. I am not going to spend a lot of time talking about sexuality as such. This is an even more recent transformation than gender relations. Gender relations began their very sustained transformation in the 1960s. The dramatic transformations in the views around sexuality, particularly around the very complex intersection of sexuality with gender, sort of the sexuality-gender connection, which is not the sex difference gender combination, but the sexuality gender interaction, That's really complicated social issues to think through. Those transformations began in earnest in the 70s and accelerating in the 80s and 90s. The, I think, clearest indication that we're living and moving into a different world is reflected in the data on public support for same-sex marriage, which is probably now even above 50%. The latest survey that I had in the book was for 2009. I suspect it's probably in the mid-50s by now. And if you look at the age differences in support for same-sex marriage, it's just a very, very sharp age gradient. It's pretty clear, unless there's some dramatic change in the attitudes of young people, which I just don't see happening. It's pretty clear to me that as the older people die off, the broad consensus in much of the United States that people who love each other should be able to marry regardless of sexual orientation, that that will become the dominant, taken-for-granted position, as opposed to the embattled sort of leading-edge views of Americans in the future. And whether you think this is a good or bad thing, whatever else you might think, it's certainly a massive change. The earliest surveys about same-sex marriage were in the 1990s because it never even occurred to any survey researcher to ask the question before the 1990s. It was so off the agenda, so out of the cultural space of what would be considered a legitimate question to ask somebody, that it wasn't even on the cultural horizon until the 1990s. And the support for it, again, has gone up quite dramatically. Well, those are the transformations. That's the kind of roadmap of what's changed in the United States. And of course, this is not just the US. This is a global phenomenon. You know, even in the parts of the world where gender relations seem in horrific ways to be stuck back in the Middle Ages, you know, in Saudi Arabia where women are not allowed to drive, or I think actually recently they, I may be wrong about that, I think very recently women may have been given permission to get driver's licenses. In any case, there are places in the world where gender relations just seem unbelievably backward in terms of this historical sweep of what we've been talking about. But even in those places, bubbling up are these radical transformations, often below the surface, often behind closed doors. The question then is, how do we explain it? Why is it in the beginning of the 21st century, half of medical students are women, whereas 50 years ago it was under 10%. How do we explain the fact that women's labor force participation has increased so massively, that the percentage of people who are living in married couple households has declined so much? How do we explain the fact that the gender division of labor within households is no longer taken for granted? Even in households which maintain a relatively traditional division of labor, with the mothers doing overwhelmingly most of the childcare and housework and the husbands not, even in such households, it's no longer just simply taken for granted. It's something that has to be negotiated, decided upon. It's part of the discussion of intimate life, not just the background taken for grantedness of the roles. How do we explain such massive changes? And here's the question, and it's a difficult question. I'll review the question today, and then on Thursday we'll look at the answer. So here's the way to think about the question. Women have always tried to increase their autonomy and reduce their subjection. This is nothing new. That was true in the colonial period in the United States, in the 19th century, in the early 20th century. It's true in peasant societies. It's true in Saudi Arabia. Women have always tried to increase their autonomy and reduce their subjection. But throughout most of history, these struggles have produced, at best, minimal changes. So the question then is, why do these struggles produce big changes sometimes and not others? Why, in the second half of the 20th century, were there such massive transformations? It's not a new thing that women have resisted their subordination and their treatment by men as subordinate persons. What's new is their capacity to successfully transform those relations. And let me just give you the general shape of the answer, and then we'll look at the details on Thursday. While women have tried throughout history to increase their autonomy and reduce their subordination, they could only succeed in doing this on a large scale once social conditions had changed in ways that made existing gender relations fragile. So something happens in the 20th century, especially starting in the 50s and accelerating afterwards, something happens which undercuts the foundations of the existing gender relations, which makes them more fragile, more transformable. There's something that erodes, if you want to use some fancier language, erodes their conditions of stability. And that's what we have to explore, is how these relations that have been intact in basically the same kind of form for thousands of years, how their foundations so quickly erode so that they can be transformed. And that's the way I think to think about social change in general. People want to change things. They usually fail. Why do they succeed? Sometimes something changes which makes the institutions that they're challenging more vulnerable, more fragile. And the fragility of gender relations are what we will explain on Thursday. And go out and vote. It's your chance.